When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of the Playlist Podcast is brought to you by Rebuilding Paradise. Ron Howard's Rebuilding Paradise from National Geographic Documentary Films recounts the devastating fires of November 2018 when the city of Paradise, California was engulfed in flames. These were the deadliest U.S. fires in 100 years and the worst ever in California's history. By the time they were extinguished, the fires had shattered the city with 85 people killed, 50,000 residents displaced, many without homes to return to, and 95% of local structures destroyed. Hailed by Variety as inspiring and the Los Angeles Times as a stirring portrait, harrowing and heartrending, Rebuilding Paradise is, most importantly, the story of resilience in the face of tragedy as a community stricken by disaster comes together to rebuild and recover. For more information, visit natgeotv.com/FYC. Welcome to The Playlist Podcast, a weekly discussion of films and TV. I'm your host, Charles Barfield, managing editor of The Playlist. And this week, as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts, Mike D'Angelo and Brian Farver. Are you guys ready to argue it out like filmmakers that forgot to thank their significant others during a speech?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Yeah, it was a little bit long, I know. Okay, so yeah, this week we're discussing Malcolm and Marie, the new Netflix drama that's getting all sorts of awards buzz for the stars Zendaya and John David Washington, as well as writer-director Sam Levinson. And speaking of Mr. Levinson, after we discuss the film, make sure you stick around to hear our interview with the filmmaker, where he talks about Malcolm and Marie and that little HBO show he created called Euphoria, and his dad, who happens to be filmmaker Barry Levinson. And you may even hear us talk about Toys, that movie from the 90s. But before we get to any of that, I got to tell you, The Playlist Podcast is part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which includes The Discourse, Be Real, The Fourth Wall, and more. And if you want to find us, you can check out your podcast app of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, Anchor, Stitcher, anywhere else you find your favorite shows. Okay, guys, so let's discuss Malcolm and Marie. As mentioned, this is the new Netflix film that stars Zendaya and John David Washington. The film follows the story of a filmmaker that comes home from a very successful film premiere to find that his significant other is upset because he failed to thank her during a speech. The two then verbally battle over the course of one evening, testing the limits of their relationship. And the reason we're talking about this, other than it being kind of an awards-friendly movie, is that it's also unique in that it was one of the first films that actually entered production during the pandemic. In fact, the film was conceived, written, and produced last summer and is now done in time to be discussed for award season. First, let's get your overall thoughts. Mike, why don't you lead us?
Yeah, I absolutely positively loved Malcolm and Marie, and I did not expect to love it. I'm not a huge fan of like black and white two-handers, basically. I mean, I don't know how else to put it, but that's kind of what this is. And
you are a noted hater of all things black and white and two-handed, so
I will take that and write it on my tombstone. But yeah, basically this is a super solid movie that isn't really like flashy in many ways outside of really great cinematography and really, really great performances by the two only actors in the movie, which are John David Washington and Zendaya, or Zendaya. I genuinely don't know which one is which.
Zendaya.
Oh, sorry, super fan. Basically, it's a really simple story about, you know, a director who's so in love with himself, his head's up his ass, and his girlfriend, who, you know, is a former addict, and things kind of unravel as the story goes on, and you kind of change your opinion as far as their relationship goes multiple times. And it's really good about evolving these characters over a single night. And really, as we were watching it, we mentioned this in the interview as well, but as soon as it was done, my wife and I looked at each other. I was like, I just feel like I just watched like a boxing match or something, because it was like they would fight and be awful to each other, and then they'd break off and there would be a cigarette break and music would come on, or someone would scarf
literally though
mac and cheese.
Sure that we're literally saying that that's literally they will go and smoke a cigarette and then play a song
and then get right back into a new round. Let's do this. And it would start off nice, and they, you know, do little love taps, and then all of a sudden they're swinging for the fences before the bell rings and they have to separate again. But it's so good. Like the acting from both of these people, which I know you said it's gathering a lot of awards buzz as of today, which today is the day that the Golden Globe nominations dropped. It was robbed of any nominations. I didn't see it on there at all. So to say that, you know, Zendaya and John David Washington didn't get nominated for these just outstanding performances, like John David Washington needs a Best Actor nom for the Oscars. If he does not get it, I don't know what to do with the Oscars anymore. There's no justice. But
that's the hill you're going to die on.
That is it. It must be John David Washington.
Not Denzel.
Denzel Jr.
Yeah, not Denzel.
No, The Little Things was fine. He was fine. He was Denzel.
This is JDW's time.
This is Denzel Jr. And I am so in it. So basically, I loved it. I thought, you know, both of them put on just like heart-wrenching performances, or just there were times where I was laughing like to the point of tears when John David Washington would work himself up into just a manic state and just be screaming or yelling either from a different room or just right next to her, but like she's in a different room. And it was crazy. And at one point he bites her ass for no real reason at all. And I enjoyed it, you know, get in there.
There are some very sexy times in this movie, for sure.
It's true. Mm-hmm.
And with that in mind, let's go to Brian.
Yeah, take it away.
What was the sexiest moment of this movie for you?
the sexiest moment. I don't know.
Or you could just tell us what you liked about this movie.
Yeah, it was probably I think it was shot on 16 millimeter film. That's pretty hot.
Ooh. If you're the mac and cheese scene.
Easily the hottest of all millimeters. Oh yeah, the mac and cheese scene. Yeah. But yeah, like Mike said, I mean the nominations. It should happen. It's interesting when I look at both of these actors, because to be completely honest, I haven't been completely on board with Zendaya up until now. The other films I've seen her in, nothing has really clicked for me. I'm not talking
even
about
Spider-Man.
Not even Spider-Man. Okay. No, fair. But this time she's turned a corner. And John David Washington, I mean, I'm in the minority here, but I just did not enjoy him in Black Klansman. In fact, I didn't really enjoy Black Klansman, just to be honest. Wow. But I
thought you were about to say Tenet, and then we were going to be best friends.
Yes. Well,
no, Tenet, he's great in that.
Yes. And with this
as protagonist.
His career has really crescendoed, but in a big way with this one. This is another movie, and I think we've talked about a few other films on this podcast that I would love to see as a play. The way that it's filmed is super unique. I do like the black and white. I think it looks really cool, but I would just love to see this as a play. I think that could be a really cool, very intimate experience. Yeah, I mean, I think about other films that have kind of that dual aspect to them. It's not the best comparison, but like War of the Roses, even though that's more of a comedy, but movies like that, the sparring, like you said, Mike, the boxing match, I love those. And this one could be one of the best. And I think you even said too, Mike, at one point, like that these two are just completely acting their asses off. Like they are. I mean, they're just giving it 100%. And that is where any movie where the leads are delivering in such a way, you know, you could say, oh, that really saved the movie. But no, I mean, the material they had to work with was just as strong. So yeah, this is a great movie. Again, it's not one I'm going to revisit often just because it is fairly intense, but these two, not only do they deserve some major nominations for this, but I'm really excited to see what they're going to do next. I'm excited for Spider-Man 3 now a little bit more. And okay. I was already excited.
Enough about Spider-Man 3.
Yeah.
I got to ask you, Brian, because this is not the first time you said this is not a movie I'm going to revisit often.
No.
Please, for the listeners at home, explain to them what are the movies you visit often?
Oh, well, let's see.
They're usually obscure TV movies from the 80s.
wait, let's pull back the curtain. Before we hit record, what were the movies you were talking about?
See, I mean, well, there's your Rocketeers. There's The Wizard with Fred Savage.
No. You mentioned one movie, two movies.
Mr. Boogity?
No. Boogity? Before tonight, you had said we can talk about Garfield. What was it?
Oh, yeah. Garfield's Halloween Adventure, which also was known as Garfield in Disguise in the novelization.
So for the people at home, when you hear Brian say this is not a movie I'm going to watch often, that's because he's going back to Garfield's Halloween Adventure.
Man, those pirates in that movie are something else. They are fierce looking. Okay.
Not a single person knows who you're talking about. Yeah.
You are talking to, I think, who's it? Jim Davis, who created Garfield?
Jimmy Davis. Yes.
I don't know. Davis. Do you guys know him as Jimmy? Apparently.
You guys you know, I do have his autograph, but that's neither here nor there.
Anyway.
In my basement. I mean, whatever.
Okay, I just mentioned that because I think that's funny that we were talking. You know everything about Garfield, but you're like Malcolm and Marie. Yeah, it's good, but I won't rewatch as much as Garfield.
Again, this obviously Malcolm and Marie, much better film, much better project overall. It's just a lot. It's a lot to deal with. But again, it looks great. Sam Levinson, like I love most of what his dad has done. I mean, The Natural is probably one of my favorite movies ever. And, you know, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree with this one. Great, great work all around.
Cool.
So it's very comparable to The Natural. Yes.
It's the same movie, essentially.
I was actually, I'm just poking fun, obviously, at Brian because he had mentioned Garfield before we started recording. And I think that's funny. But
right.
I will agree that this is definitely not a movie I'm going to pop in on a Saturday afternoon and enjoy with the wife. Because I tell you what, they really go at each other, Malcolm and Marie do. Like, the barbs that they exchange are wow. Like, there is no holds barred. They are going for everything possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's like sexual escapades, whether that's drug use, whether it's abuse, it's just not everything. You're like, oh boy.
Yeah, I do want to add that I in no way think they should be together, these two characters.
Oh no.
They are toxic for sure.
Yeah.
That said, it is really good. And when you have a movie that is two people in a house over the course of like almost real time arguing, the acting is really what has to carry it, because if one of those two don't deliver, it's going to be just unwatchable. And this is thoroughly watchable. In fact, like the way the dialogue is written, I think Sam Levinson talks about this in the interview, but it's so like quick and fast that like you just are entranced from the get-go. The only moments where the movie slows down are those like interstitial moments where they have the cigarette and the song, or you know, sexy time, as it were. And those moments are great because it does break up the flow a little bit, but it just gives you time to breathe for a second, because boy, it's intense watching these two. And all of it comes down to Zendaya and John David Washington. They're on like next level acting in this. And I think when people watch it, people are really going to fall in love with both of these actors on a whole other level. And I think the reviews, which have been some have been mixed, are a bit harsh on this movie, because I think it's not a movie that is like this next level dissection of what it is to be human, you know, from the perspective of two people. Like, this is a movie about people fighting and a relationship on the brink. And it is full of monologues, incredible monologues that probably will be used in acting classes, because they're just like full of like, you know, all this room to literally dance on the walls and stuff. So, yeah. I mean, it's a great movie. It's a lot of fun to watch, in fun meaning, you know, watching two great actors do their best, not fun in the sense that like, you know, if you don't have a strong relationship, this might like be a little too close to home. But I did watch it with my wife as well. We're still married, I think. And so I think we're strong enough to survive it. So go ahead. Let's switch gears, though.
I want to ask you before we do that. I do want to say, if there's anything this was missing, it's the neighbor coming over, you know, every 15, 30 minutes or so and just going, guys, can we just, can we keep it down? Can we keep it
down?
That's true.
That's
and then
true.
They go, fuck off, Bill. And like he walks off.
Bill.
It is a Bill. It's always Bill, a Bill.
Bill Johnston.
Yep.
Also, I apologize. It was 35 millimeter, not 16 millimeter. I always get those two confused. Am I right?
I spit at you.
Common mistake. Yeah. We've all been there.
Okay. So I'm going to hit you guys with a difficult question. Who won this battle? Now, I'm not going to, I don't mean Malcolm or Marie. Because I think you could argue both ways on the plot of the movie, like who comes out quote unquote on top. I'm talking Zendaya and Washington. They're both putting on possibly career best performances here. But at the end of the day, who do you think shines the most? And if you guys pick both, you're not allowed to host again. you have to pick Zendaya.
Well,
or John
I think Washington. I got to go both on this one.
Yeah. So we're going to go Mike, who won.
For me, John David Washington, he just had a flashier role. Zendaya is definitely like acting her ass off right along with him, but he just had so many opportunities to really chew the scenery, and she had a lot of opportunities to like really get like emotional and deep, and like your heart breaks for her so many times. But man, there were like that mac and cheese scene is just, it could have been just a normal scene with any other actor where you're just like kind of bored watching this guy eat mac and cheese and just kind of yell at his girlfriend. But it is fascinating in every aspect. And he does that multiple times throughout the film. It's just insane. Like when he reads that review that loves his movie and he can't help himself. It's amazing.
Okay, fair. You picked one. You succeeded. Brian, your turn. Put you on the spot. Zendaya or Washington, who won?
It's good old Washington. And I did like there is kind of a fragile nature to Zendaya, that which I love. But you're right. The chewing the scenery is almost exactly what I was going to say. He's really going for it, which, you know, makes me wonder, like, how much was that, you know, Levinson's direction? How much was him just, you know, really letting the reins go loose? Or what was it? I don't know. But either way, I mean, he completely brought it. And that's not to say that she was bad, because she wasn't. I love what she did too. But yeah, Washington for sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think we're gonna call it, you know, like a majority decision. It's not gonna be, there's no clear knockout here for sure, sticking with the boxing analogy. Because you're right, like at the end of the day, both of these people did really well. So when we pick, it's mainly for fun because I like putting you guys on the spot, but also it's with the knowledge that both of them did like awards worthy performances. But for me, I'm gonna go contrarian here. I'm gonna say Zendaya really surprised me.
Classic Charles.
I know. I just, you know, you zig, I zag. That's just how I roll. But like,
that's true.
No, but for real, for me, I think Zendaya, you had mentioned like she didn't really impress you, Brian, in other performances. And for me, I'm surprisingly not a Disney stan. So like, I didn't see her early Disney Channel stuff. So I can't reference that. Mm-hmm. A lot of what I saw her in is bits and pieces of Euphoria and the Spider-Man movies. And I think this is like a window into her being this kind of like adult actress. This isn't her trying to play a teenager anymore. She's very adult in this. And sure, she's playing like a younger person. There's a big age gap here, but I wouldn't call it fragility. It's the vulnerability that she puts on display is pretty incredible. And there's one scene, I'm not going to spoil it, but there's one scene where she has a knife. That's all I'll say. Boy, what a tease. And it is one of the coolest things in this movie, I think. And she does, it's like another one of those monologues that they have. And this one is something that she shows like an entire range over like 3 minutes. And it's really incredible. And John David Washington is chewing the scenery and he is doing it incredibly well. And he literally, like I said, he dances like on shelves and windowsills and it's nuts. But I think it takes a lot for her to play off that and to kind of be a little bit more reserved and also just carry the emotional side of this. And I think it works well. So yeah, Zendaya for me, but you know, majority of decision, Washington it is. He's the title holder.
I agree. I agree with everything you said. She's amazing in it. But he was another level for me.
Fair enough. Let's wrap up our discussion so we can get to this interview with Sam Levinson. Any final thoughts for Malcolm and Marie, Mike O'Brien?
Watch it. It's awesome.
Give it a watch.
I mean, you're already subscribed to Netflix. You might as well. And it's definitely, I think it's only about 90 minutes. It's a pretty quick watch too. So I highly recommend it, especially if you are interested in Zendaya and or John David Washington, because I think this is going to be kind of their movie that they point to where you're like, damn, they're good. So yeah, give it a shot. So thanks for discussing the movie with me, guys. Let's kick it over to the interview. Keep listening. Thanks. First, I got to say, love the movie, but also this might be your cinematic tour de force, your masterwork. So I hope I got that right. but seriously, I think before we get into the actual story of the film, I think it's worthwhile for the people listening if you just kind of give the quick rundown of how this came together, because I think the story of how this came together is incredibly timely and also very interesting.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate being here, and I'm excited to talk to you guys. But look, it's funny, just the way this whole thing came together. We had been shut down on Euphoria a day before we were supposed to start principal production on season two, and went back home, as did everybody. And you know, I spent quite a bit of time just talking to Z because we were prepping season two and there's some pretty extensive just character stuff. Rue was going to go through quite a bit. And after a few weeks, you know, it's like, what if we were to make a movie? Maybe we could shoot something in, you know, my house. And, you know, she was proposing. And so I think just to keep us sane, I was just pitching 1,000 different completely insane ideas. And after a certain point, I think, you know, once we heard that Euphoria was getting pushed to September at that time, this window opened and I had thought, well, what if we just make a movie with no bells and whistles, no props, no special effects, no location. It's just two people in a house and there's just no gimmicks to it. And, you know, she said, well, what's the idea? And I said, I don't know, maybe it's like a filmmaker forgets to thank his partner, which was something that I had forgot to thank my wife at the premiere of Assassination Nation. And we didn't have a big blow up fight about it. In fact, I think we only talked about it on the car ride home, but it kind of ignited all of these conversations inside of myself and thoughts about acknowledgement and relationships. And I thought it was just like an interesting inciting incident. So I just sat down and started writing. I didn't care about act structure. I didn't care about what it was about, themes, anything. I just wrote and it was almost sort of like a Socratic dialogue to get to understand these characters. So I just started writing what he's saying. She either agrees with it, disagrees, thinks he's full of shit. She starts to dig deeper and it just unfolds from there. And in many ways, this movie was just sort of simply an exercise, in the sense that we were wondering if we could do something safely with the restrictions of COVID, tell a story that didn't feel like it had the limitations of COVID imposed on it, and also too, just get our crew back to work. You know, because they've had my back for, you know, years on Euphoria. And if I could in some way write something and get something up on its feet, then, you know, and people could get back to work safely and earn a living and have some ownership in this movie, then it felt like an exciting challenge for us to all do.
Just building off of that ownership aspect, I read somewhere where the crew who signed on for this, because of the structure and the small amount of money you guys had to build this movie, everybody kind of got like that ownership stake in it. And eventually, like some money ended up going to Feeding America. Is that right?
Yeah, because we also, look, since we were self-financing it together, we didn't have to deal with like the normal financier is going to come in and like take 50% of it. And then it all gets complicated and weird. Like our back end structure is literally, I think it's like a page long. And it was just, you know, key department heads, ownership. We carved out back end for charity in the event that this movie sold, that it would, and was successful in any way. We could help people who were out of work or struggling, just, you know, put food on the table, which is the most primal fucking concern. And yeah, I mean, it was just, we also, I think it's a structure that I feel like should exist just in general. I've never understood why Marcel Rev, our cinematographer, Julio Perez, the editor, you know, I've worked with on a number of things, like, why don't they have ownership in a movie? Why don't they have back end? They are as integral as any other person on that project to its success, to its creativity. And so it felt like if we can create a model out of this situation that we can maybe point to in the future as something that can be done, then it would be good for just the business in general.
That's yeah. Great.
I'm interested in seeing if anybody else picks that up and starts kind of taking the ball and running with it as far as that goes. I guess the question that while I was watching the movie, it kind of came to mind is in recent years, there's been a conversation about, you know, who should be able to convey a certain culture's experience in the arts. And what I wanted to know is if you felt any trepidation taking on scenes when it comes to, you know, dissecting the business from a Black perspective, or if that was born kind of out of a dialogue with your cast, or kind of how it came to be, or is this just kind of a film that's a critique of a part of the film is a critique on that viewpoint altogether? What do you feel on that?
Look, I think that, you know, historically speaking, Hollywood has not been interested in Black storytellers telling their stories from their perspective. That's just a fact. And so I think now that there's a certain awareness of that, and it's and how stories don't feel representative of certain, you know, just of the vast sort of array of human experience, the bar is a little bit higher. In that sense, there's more scrutiny, which I think is deserved and warranted. I'm also very much a believer that film and the making of film, just the process of it, is a collision of all identities. That's the beautiful part of filmmaking. You're on set, you're working with, you know, hundreds of people, and everyone brings their unique kind of perspective to it. And if you remain open to that, if you're collaborative, if you listen, you can end up finding something or capturing something, hopefully, that feels universal. So back to just the pure logistics of it, I knew I was writing a script for Zendaya. About 10 seconds into writing that script, I knew it was also going to be John David Washington, because I could not imagine anybody else. I loved him in Monsters and Men, Black Klansman. I know him a little bit through his sister, Katia Washington, who's been a producer on a number of projects that I've done. And so at that point, I also knew that I was writing about a Black filmmaker in Hollywood today. And I thought, well, does he not have any issues with the industry?
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I took certain feelings that are maybe specific to me from my perspective, and I put them into the character. And I also had faith that, you know, these actors who are also producers on this project, if they had any questions or issues or thoughts, that we would figure the shit out, because that's just the nature of it. And we'd iron out this, oh, you know, this happened to me this time. Oh, great. Oh, that's interesting. Let's see. Let's put that in there and this thing, you know, and that's just the collaborative process. It's what makes, it's what makes filmmaking so beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And it felt, I don't want to say the word authentic because I think you've cursed it for me. From this time out, I'm going to, like, when I'm writing reviews, I'm just going to be like, don't say that word. Don't type it.
It's funny. I use the word as well. And now I find myself just, I catch myself and I go, oh, well, maybe I should, I don't know. But it's a great word though. And it means something. I just think with lots of things in the world today, their meaning is slowly sort of disappearing.
Yeah.
Just in general. And they get a little bit overused.
The structure of this film, really, really interesting. I mean, it's told largely in real time over a few hours, and then watching the ebbs and flows, the dialogue and the emotion, it almost feels like two people almost in a boxing match. I mean, there's little jabs, counters and uppercuts and, you know, a couple of figurative knockdowns. And then the round is over and they go to their corners, so to speak. And eventually the next round begins. Is
cigarette music break, you know, all
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes
exactly.
There's a little intermission. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Cigarette break.
That flow, is that something you purposefully constructed, or did it just kind of come naturally?
I think that's a really interesting question. I'm always so nervous about people's attention spans because I know how short my own attention span is. And as a filmmaker, there's nothing more terrifying than going like, oh, are people going to just like fucking watch 10 minutes and then flip to something else?
Right.
And so I think like with Euphoria, for instance, which is not a dialogue heavy show, I wanted to create something that felt like it was so fast moving that if you looked away for 4 seconds, we would leave you in the dust. And we tried to do that in a visual way. I think knowing that we didn't have any of those tools and the restrictions that sort of COVID was forcing upon us, the idea was, can I do the same thing with dialogue? Can I take these characters' dialogue and make it so rapid and their arguments so extensive and sprawling that if you looked away for any period of time, you'd go, wait, where are we? What's happening? And I think that's probably that's sort of the inception of it. And then also at the same time, I think Marcel and I were really curious about how to take something that dialogue heavy, but still create something that felt cinematic and we could move with it and sort of weave in between the characters. We had a kind of a slightly different plan when we first started shooting than we ended up throwing out the first 2 days of shooting completely, because I think our sort of formalist ideas weren't lining up with the kind of reality on the ground. So it's like, we were like, we want to do this like a Preminger film where everything is beautifully choreographed, dolly shots. We shot a whole day and it was just suffocating the actors. And it also looked like a fucking, like a cologne or whiskey commercial. And we like got into the car. We were on at that time it was a 10-day schedule. And I looked at Marcel and I was like, dude, this ain't gonna work. We got to throw this shit out. And he's like, I completely agree. So we threw out the first day, we go back, I say to the actors, so you remember like the 80 takes we did of the first, like, you know, 15, 20 pages, just say, we're going to throw all that out and we're going to start again. We're going to do the whole thing handheld. You know, we never see handheld black and white. We want to do something like bullet ballet. It should be rough and messy and capture the life. Marcel and I thought we had this whole shit figured out. We pitch it to the actors. They're like, great. All right, well, we'll go again. We shoot that whole day. Towards the end of the day, I'm looking at Marcel. He's like covered in sweat. He's got a 1,000-foot mag on his shoulder for like 8 straight hours. And I just kind of shake my head and he shakes his head. And we both know in that instant, like, we're throwing this whole day out as well.
Oh, man.
And then finally, it started to click. I think once we were kind of paying attention to just the movement of it and the space of it. And we weren't trying to force anything on it, but we were just trying to capture it as it happened in a way that felt engaging and true and honest to the characters. It was a movie that I consistently felt I was catching up to. I'm a big believer that if you ever feel confident on set, then you're fucking doing something wrong and it's going to be a disaster. And this was maybe the most anxious I had ever been of a project.
I mean, it must stink to throw away two of your, what, like 14 days of shooting, but yeah,
it was 10 at that time. That's why we had to go get a few couple extra days. You know?
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. I have to say that the angry mac and cheese eating moment is one of the most inspired bits of filmmaking I've seen in a long time. And it really, and in the larger sense, it speaks to the commitment that both Zendaya and John David Washington put into every moment of this movie. So when you write a scene where you're like, you know, he angrily eats his mac and cheese while yelling at her, is that something where you're like, man, this sounds great in my head and on paper, but you know, I've got John David Washington, but is this like even too much for him? Like, how many bowls of mac and cheese can this guy eat?
I mean, look, I always imagine that he was eating and he was so just happy about the food, but he was still trying to keep this argument going. Like, yeah, cause he was still annoyed by it. But I gotta be honest, when he like sat down, rolled up his sleeves and just started eating it in that animalistic way, I was fucking just blown away. It was so insane and funny and honest. And I just couldn't, he had tapped into this kind of this like mania that felt so right for the character. And that it was just, I was so excited. I actually didn't even shoot any coverage on it because I loved it so much. And then finally, I think it was the next day, I was like, oh no, it's so good that I don't want to have to actually make any compromises. So maybe I'll go back and like cover it from behind or, you know, another way. Cause it was just his grunting and how he grunts in the middle of arguing is kills me. It's a brilliant piece of acting.
The sound too, yeah, of the squish,
you're stabbing, oh, at the mac and cheese.
Yeah. And
that's all production audio. That's all, yeah, production audio.
That's incredible. Yeah. My wife actually was watching the movie with me, and the moment he flips his tie over his shoulder, she goes, that alone would annoy me. And like, I was like, yeah, I could see that. Like, it was just perfect. Yeah. Anyway.
He's got a couple of moments in the movie like that. Like the review meltdown scene is nuts. And it's a review where he's getting praised by and large. And it just felt like pure catharsis. And I have to imagine it felt good to write that and to see it played out in that way. But one, how did it feel to write that? And two, do you feel bad for the inevitable white girl from the LA Times that has to write the review about this?
Well, you know, it's funny. I grew up really loving film criticism, and mm-hmm. and I really honestly believe that film criticism is probably as important to the future of filmmaking as filmmaking is itself. I guess.
Are you saying that because you're talking to us, though?
No, I'm dead serious. Okay. I'm dead serious in the sense that because it actually provides, and I think that when people write thoughtfully and interrogate the ideas in movies and the techniques and the form of it, it gives filmmakers a blueprint for how to mine emotion and convey it and how to tell stories in ways that they didn't think of before. I think that's what the best criticism does, personally. What I'm less interested in is the kind of the criticism that feels sort of like a book report, you know, it's sort of like a synopsis,
yeah,
with some adjectives. And then, that tends to be more about reading the culture than the material. Mm-hmm. That's what I think is a little, can sometimes frustrate me. Just personally. And, but I, you know, what's funny is I don't know if I actually agree with everything Malcolm says. And it's funny because I see a lot of kind of responses, or I hear like, oh, well, that's how you must feel about film critics. And I go, kind of at times there's aspects of it, but I also agree with Marie. And I think that that's, I think my heart is with Marie in many ways, because I think that there are these aspects of who you are that bleed into things. And I'm not, I don't know, there's a, her, and I think that you can also find value even in the simplest sort of ideas, just about your own work as an artist. And I think, so I'm sure because I'm a filmmaker, because the character of Malcolm's a filmmaker, it's going to feel like people will inevitably sort of read it as just me venting about all of my own grievances. But I actually don't believe that that's true. And I also think what I was trying to tap into is more the mania of making something and then having to watch people respond to it, but not necessarily be able to respond to the response, which is this very odd feeling, because you're, you know, and I think just sometimes when you make a movie, you go, oh, people are going to completely understand this. And then they don't. They don't understand it. And maybe they don't understand it because you didn't do it effectively. It's got flaws or shortcomings, but it's always this fucking weird moment of, oh shit, I didn't actually convey what I felt there. And there's a frustration that kind of comes out of it. But I also think at the same time, he's talking about, I think his grievance in particular is something that, you know, I can understand maybe from a Jewish perspective of like, and just thinking about Jewish playwrights in the past, like Arthur Miller not wanting to make Death of a Salesman a Jewish family, changing the kids' names to like Biff and Happy so it doesn't get dismissed by, you know, the critics at the time is like, oh, this is about this certain subsection of the population and isn't about American families or isn't about human beings in general. And I think so there's a number of different things that I think he's saying within it, but I don't know, that's sort of my scattered response to that.
No, I think that's important. Like you said, I mean, when you make a movie about a filmmaker, obviously everybody thinks like, oh, well, he's just talking to us directly. So it's important that you clear that up. Otherwise, yeah, there are going to be some reviewers thinking like, oh, what an asshole.
I know. Well, Marie's a recovering drug addict. Mm-hmm. That is sort of an extension of the character of Rue in Euphoria. And I see myself as much in her as I do in Malcolm, but it's also, it's not like I had some kind of plan with this movie. I just tried to write each character into a fucking hole every single day and then try to dig myself out of it the next day until I had something long enough to go shoot with people that I liked. Yeah. And it wasn't like a super intellectual process in that regard.
It's amazing how well the film turned out when it's just kind of like flowing.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. It really is.
And you did bring up Euphoria, and I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it just for a couple minutes. In December, you released a standalone episode focused on Zendaya, and then there's another one coming focused on another character. And I gotta say, because my wife is a mental health therapist, and she loves Euphoria, and she watched the episode with Zendaya and was like devastated by it, because she's dealt with addiction issues with people, and she's had that conversation so many times with people that she was like, it's almost too hard to watch. So kudos on that. But you mentioned that Malcolm and Marie came at a point when you were about to do season two, and here we are a year later, no season two, COVID's still around. So I think Zendaya may have said that you guys were shooting for spring. Has that changed? And at this point, is 2021 just going to be Euphoria free?
So we're aiming for a March start date. No, I actually think Euphoria is going to be possible in 2021. And 2022. So that's the that's the plan as of now. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a really kind of sprawling show. And so it's hard to figure it out logistically, in terms of COVID and to do it safely. And I gotta be honest, HBO has been incredible with that stuff. Cause I think first and foremost, I love the people that I work with and we have to do it safely. And I think a lot of what we've been trying to figure out is how can we pull this off safely and still keep the same scope. But, you know, at the same time, and I know that this, I don't know, maybe this seems odd, but I'm grateful that we didn't shoot season two when we were going to shoot it, just in the sense that I felt like I didn't necessarily have enough distance from season one in a way. And I just mean that I really always want to kind of insulate myself from like reactions to things or, oh, people like this, they didn't like that, because I really get in my own head about it. And there's also the shit that I'm super self-critical about in terms of just my work in general and things that I want to try and push and experiment with. And so I feel like I was still a little too close to it in a way, and being able to go into Malcolm and Marie and make these COVID episodes just gave me like enough distance to come back and attack it in a way that feels exciting and feels like it's going to progress. Cause I think the one thing that I'm always sort of wary of with television is like that you just keep trying to recreate the same thing that people seem to enjoy the first time around. And while you want to stay true to the spirit of it, you also want to make sure that it grows, because otherwise I would just get bored.
Yeah.
Going back to the same kitchen to shoot the same thing with the same lighting, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's, yeah, I hope that it can keep evolving and changing and in exciting ways. And I don't mean that in like a highbrow, like fucking, you know, like, oh,
it's going to be black and white just, season 2.
Yeah. No. Black and white monologues. Like, no, I mean, I just mean like from, just, you know, I just, you know, you don't want to go back and fucking repeat yourself. But it's still going to have its insane spirit. That can't change. That's the one thing.
Perfect. And yeah, really, really quick, I just want to squeeze this in here. Did you and your dad have a version of, I guess we'll say, the talk where you told him about your career choice? I mean, was he apprehensive with you getting into the biz, or did he have any sage advice for you? I mean, how did that all play out?
He put you in toys after all. He kind of threw you in there.
Did put you in toys. Yes.
That's true. It's, I remember those sets were, I think it was Fernando Scarfetti who designed them. Those sets were incredible in that movie. But you know, it's funny. My dad is, I think, one of my closest friends. And just growing up, you know, it's like anytime he wasn't working, he was just watching Turner Classic Movies. and so I would just, as long as I can remember, I'd go in and I just watch movies with him, and we would just talk about movies. You know, he's a Jewish kid from Baltimore who's just like was enamored with just being in a dark theater and stories and characters and the scope of film. And so he's just a fun person to talk to about movies. And that's kind of all we did growing up, was like movies, politics, and sports. I don't really know that much about. And so we never really had a conversation about it in that regard. Cause I think, you know, I think it was always like, you should do whatever you want to do in life. And, you know, and because if you're not passionate about it, then I think you're going to run into some trouble. You know, so we never had that conversation, but I always kind of, I don't know, we're always kicking ideas around. I watch Kutza, his work, and he watches Kutza, my work. He's, you know, I'm really grateful for our relationship. And it's surprisingly, like, I don't know, people always ask me like, is it weird? Is it contentious? Like, as if, and I'm always like, no, it's fucking beautiful. It's like a really, it's something I'm really grateful for.
What?
Yeah. It's like a healthy, it's a healthy, great relationship. And there's no ego. There's no bullshit. Like, you know, it's, and he's able, because he's been writing so long, and it's like, there's sometimes he just looks at things in such a practical way that you go, oh fuck, how did I miss that? You know, like, and it's not like from a particularly academic perspective. It's just always like, oh, here, it's like, well, but if you're having trouble with this scene and you don't know where to go, why not just go back to the previous scene and see if something's wrong with it? And you go, oh, right. Yes. Good thought. You know?
That's great. Well, we got to wrap up, but I want to thank you for joining us, Sam Levinson, director of Malcolm and Marie. We loved chatting with you, and the movie's great. So again, thank you for joining us. It's been awesome. Well,
thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it. And I hope to talk to you guys again soon. This has been fun, man.
Yeah. Likewise. When Euphoria comes out in 2021.
Yeah. Word.
You heard it here.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.